Are vegans actually unhealthy?
Does cannabis ruin your sleep?
And why are so many men taking testosterone supplements? I'm Mitch.
And I'm Greg.
And we're the creators of the popular YouTube channel ASAP Science.
Every week on our podcast Side Note by ASAP Science, we explain the science behind a controversial subject with recent research, up-to-date studies, and ridiculous stories so you are entertained while, bam, simultaneously learning.
We're here to make science make sense.
Download Side Note by ASAP Science wherever you get your podcasts.
Here in Canada, we have one of the world's best economies. It gets better almost every year. And yet, somehow, almost every year, more people are hungry.
According to a new study by Statistics Canada, more than 1 million families struggle to put nutritious food on the table or enough food at all, affecting 8% of Canadian adults and 5% of children.
This is the holiday season, and it's a time when food banks struggle to feed the thousands of people who need them. We need to talk about why that is. This year, the Daily Bread Food Bank's Who's Hungry report took a comprehensive look at who is using food banks and how they end up there. And they tried to reconcile the idea of a rising number of hungry people with that image we have of Canada as a prosperous country. Something doesn't add up. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is The Big Story. Neil Hetherington is the CEO of the Daily Bread Food Bank. Hi, Neil.
How are you?
I'm great, thank you. Thanks for taking the time for us.
It's great to be here. It really is.
So before we get into the new report you've published and what that changes, can you explain, first of all, the right to food?
The right to food is an overarching concept that Daily Bread has adopted this year, which moves the needle, I think, when it comes to how charitable acts are done. If you think about sort of traditional charity, it's somebody in need. They come into a food bank. They say, hey, I need something, and it's handed to them, and they go on their way. A right to food says, no, you know what? You have the right to this. You have the right to housing. You have the right to live decently. We just need to be, we'll be a catalyst for you to be able to get that right. And so it talks about, you know, who has the duty to be able to make sure that that happens. And in our case, what we often say is that the systems in place do not allow individuals who are on low incomes to be able to thrive in the city, and therefore their right to food is being violated. And we need to do something about that. So it changes an empathetic charity model into one that is about partnership and about rights.
What does that change in terms of the work that you do?
Well, I think one of the things that it does is from a governance perspective, we mm-hmm. want to make sure that board members have lived experience, that we have clients who are on our board of directors, that there is an understanding that we're going to walk this journey together. It changes how we advocate. So if we can take that model and say there's something fundamentally wrong in the systems that are there that are causing people to live in poverty, it gives us a platform to right a wrong. And if we can do that, and if those rights are brought about, then I think you'll start to see things like decent, affordable housing built in the city, low-cost transportation brought about, so that people can afford the cost of living and thrive.
Tell me about how this new report kind of pushes that mentality forward and what it found.
Well, what it found very succinctly is the fact that people's rights are not being met. We went through an unfortunate record this year where there were over 1 million visits to food banks in Toronto last year. And it's at a time where, the economy is booming. It's at a time where unemployment is low, yet people's right to food is not being realized.
Right.
And you got to ask, what's going on? Why is that happening?
And so how do you do that? How do you try to quantify what's happening?
Well, we start asking questions and we go right to the source. We go to individuals who are having to make use of food banks, and we went to 1,400 clients in the course of our research, and we talked about what was going on in their lives. And you know, there were some clear patterns. On the top line of their income statement, their income is stagnant. It is, and it's simply not enough to keep up with the cost of living in the city. So income becomes a one of the recommendations in terms of how do we realize a right to food. And we talk about and make clear recommendations in terms of social policy and policies that will affect individuals in precarious employment. On the bottom side of that sort of income statement, on the expenses, we make clear recommendations when it comes to affordable housing, affordable childcare, those types of recommendations, that if you take both together, because there's no one solve to poverty, but if you take both together, we can hopefully change the systems and ensure that an individual is thriving in our community.
Over a million visits to food banks last year in Toronto. Is that a spike? Is it higher than last year? And if so, is it part of a trend, or was this a jump?
It was part of an overall trend, and one that's counterintuitive given the economy.
Right.
It was double the number of so the population grew in Toronto by about 2%. Food bank usage grew by 4%. So we know that the divide between those who have and who can make ends meet, between that and those who are thriving, is broadening. And the divide between those who have and don't is something that we want to combat and make sure that everybody has the opportunity in the city.
Who uses food banks in Toronto?
You know, this report was a lot about myth busting. You know, it was really interesting to me to see some of those myths busted. For example, 44% of food bank users have gone on to a post-secondary education. They've gone to college or university. You know, almost half of the population, and it flies in the face of, you know, you just need to go on to higher education and things will be okay. So that was a myth busted for me. Another myth, individuals who are making use of the food bank, by and large, have a higher propensity to have been in the country for plus 10 years. Mm. You know, one of the concerns that I have had in sort of a polarized community and media environment that we're in is, you know, often blaming the newcomer as the problem and the source of all concerns and ills.
Sure.
And that's not the case at all. And this report is very clear on that. The other concern that came out in terms of who's making use of food banks was the increase in propensity for individuals who are racialized to have to make use of food banks. So as an example, the Aboriginal population in Toronto is 1%, yet 5% of food bank users. In terms of the Black community, roughly 8% of the population and 24% of food bank users. And so that really causes you to self-reflect and to ask, what are the biases going on in our community that would cause that systemic challenge? And so, you know, I see it every day that I walk through and I'm part of the food bank. And it's a painful reality that I think we need to come to grips with. And advocate for those individuals and advocate alongside those individuals who are experiencing poverty.
Is there a stigma surrounding using a food bank? Because this is something that we've talked about food insecurity on this program in the past. And it's something that every time it comes up, it's been mentioned that we need to move past that because, you know, to your point, these are your university colleagues and your coworkers who have a lower income level or other factors. And how do you work around that?
Well, I think part of that is adopting a right to food model, which means that we work very hard to reduce all the barriers about coming into a food bank.
Give me some examples.
So we do not do income testing. when an individual, and that used to be the case, an individual had to prove that they were poor. And we don't do that anymore. We do not feel that we are being taken advantage of in any stretch. People don't go to food banks to take advantage of the system. We get rid of that barrier by how we interact and greet individuals. Yesterday, I had a wonderful meeting with two of my colleagues who run the food bank at New Toronto Street, and these are individuals who really value an individual, a client coming in and saying, "How can we make your day better?" And so we make it a shopping experience. It's not a here's your bag of food and please leave. It's you know, shop for your food. We're glad that you're here. We make sure that that individuals have access to all of the social benefits that they are entitled to. So we set up systems of referrals so that individuals, we can shorten the line of individuals needing food banks. But you know, if food banks are, there's an important they're an important resource to, you know, tens of thousands of people in our city. So while we have this emergency need, we will continue to fill it, but we're going to advocate for systemic changes.
How are donations? As the need for this rises, at least in Toronto.
Donations are difficult. We are very grateful for anybody who makes a food or a monetary donation to the organization, because Daily Bread needs it, and it goes, you know, into such a simple needed item, food. We just need, and so the charitable sector, in my opinion, is the most competitive sector of our economy. It represents about 10% of the economy, and there are 86,000 charities across the country, and all have brilliant missions. And so if you have to compete against 86,000 great missions and differentiate yourself, it becomes very difficult. And so...
How do you do that? That actually fascinates me, that you're in competition with so many worthy causes.
We make it known that it is that somebody's act of generosity is being used wisely and is desperately needed. And people, you know, it doesn't matter your background. We can all think about a meal. It's a commonality across cultures. Everybody knows that that is a basic right that individuals have, and I think want to see that fulfilled. And so we make that known. We work with other charities to make sure that, you know, social services are provided. And it's very difficult, but I would say Canadians want to see every individual in their neighborhood doing well. And when they're not, then they step up to the plate and they pull out their wallet or they drop off food and it's an outward expression of their inward values.
In practical terms, is it better to give food or money, and what kind of food?
Well, in practical terms, it's better to give funds, but I don't want to discount the giving of food. You know, I recall my mother taking me around Loblaws and often saying, "Here's the paper bag. You know, I want you to fill it up with food that you would like, and we'll drop it off either at a fire hall or at the end of the grocery store." And so, to give food, you have a great tangible experience that you can pass down to your children, that opportunity to think beyond yourself. So I think that there's great lessons through food to be able to give. Funds are also very much appreciated, and so is time, and so is somebody raising their hand and advocating for change. So people have the opportunity to donate, to volunteer, and to advocate, and we're grateful recipients on all three.
What changes for you both in terms of the need from clients and the donations that you get as we move into the holiday season?
So the holiday season is a time where the Daily Bread Food Bank makes or breaks the next year. It is critically important. We work very, very hard and very long hours in order to be able to mobilize that great army of volunteers to be able to raise foods and funds. And you know what changes, I would say, the need doesn't change during December, but we're reminded, you know, each and every day as we visit food banks, as food is distributed, as hope is raised, we're reminded of the need, and we can see it. And this is a time of reflection for many families. And so as they think about a season of hope, I think they want to make sure that there is hope right across sectors, right across cultures, for every individual living in the country.
How do you go about making the move from being a food bank that is on the front lines feeding people to more of the advocacy and the campaign for systemic change that you mentioned without kind of taking your eye off the ball? You mentioned like resources are limited, right? How do you do both these missions at once? What do you sacrifice?
Well, the good thing about advocacy is actually it's quite low cost to do it. It does not cost us a lot to be able to meet with a minister, to meet with a member of parliament or a city councillor, and provide them with the research and the data that supports a compelling case of poverty in the city and the solutions to it. So it's a lot of subway tokens and meetings rather than cost to do it. So our mission is clear. We will work very, very hard to increase the quantity and quality of the food that is being distributed across the network. While at the same time, we devote a full-time staff resource to mobilize the community. And we make use of all social channels, and that's actually been one of the positive things about social media is it's, you know, in terms of democratizing our ability to advocate for systemic solutions. So that is another tool that we make great use of.
Finally, what is, if you had to sum it up, one of the key takeaways from this report that you want people to understand that they may not have understood before about food insecurity?
Well, I think I would summarize the report by saying the need is growing, and the need is growing, and it's the woman or man sitting beside you on the bus or at a Tim Hortons who is in need of food banks. And unless we respond to a call of action, that need will continue to grow. And so let's respond to it joyfully and begin to work and fix those systemic challenges that we have, so that everyone in the city can escape the clutches of poverty.
Thanks for joining us, Neil.
Thank you,
Neil Hetherington, CEO of the Daily Bread Food Bank. If you'd like to help or volunteer, you can go to dailybread.ca. to find out more. For more from us, you can head to thebigstorypodcast.ca. You can also talk to us on Twitter. We're always listening at TheBigStoryFPN. And we're in every podcast application, at least all the ones we know about, where you can rate us and review us, give us 5 stars, tell your friends, like, subscribe, everything that podcast people do. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.